It's 1965, and on Bennelong Point in Sydney's Circular Quay, a strange new building is slowly taking shape. Many are suspicious of this ambitious and artistic opera house, a building designed by a foreigner and running years over time and millions over budget. Meanwhile, the Vietnam War continues, and young men and their families are closely watching the birthday ballot to see if they'll be called up to fight. This fraught time is the setting for Shell, a beautiful new novel by the Australian writer Christina Olsen. Christina, welcome.
Thanks, Claire.
Now, Christina, you took your Norwegian niece to see the Sydney Opera House in 2012. What happened?
Well, she insisted on going. In fact, she wouldn't leave the country until she did. All of my Scandinavian family claim the Opera House. Most Scandinavians do, no matter which part they come from. She and her husband and her 10-year-old twins climbed over the building, literally hands and feet. I kept looking for security guards, just having their bodies on it. You know, they absolutely felt it was theirs, and, you know, they recognised it immediately. It was miraculous to them, but not strange to them. And it was kind of one of the moments that this book was born, that I began to look at it through my own Scandinavian eyes, if you like, and see it in a very different way to the way I'd seen it before.
Because you have a Swedish father and an Australian mother, I know.
Yes.
How did this change the way that you thought about this building? Because you would have seen it before, right?
I'd seen it very rarely, shamefully, even though I'd spent some time in Sydney. My daughter lived in Sydney for a while, but I would literally go to where she was. And, you know, it wasn't on my radar, it wasn't on my compass all that much. I say shamefully now that I know so much more about it. But no, I hadn't made a beeline for it ever. I might have seen it once or twice, but I'd never, you know, physically been in it or on it the way I was that day with my niece.
So you looked at it through different eyes.
I did. And it wasn't really until we were on a ferry and going away towards Manly. And I'm not sure if you know that lovely feeling of either approaching or going away from the Opera House on a ferry. Something shifted in me. My heart shifted. And I realised that I was seeing it through these different eyes and wanted to know much more about what that feeling was all about. Why was I seeing it differently? And how was I seeing it differently? The whole idea of beauty and art came to me in a different way. It's hard to explain, but it was just one of the points.
I do think it is one of those buildings that we just love these days. I know when I go to Sydney, you go straight there and you have a cocktail and you look at the building and you admire it. But
yes.
How did the public feel about this building in 1965 when I think it was already meant to be finished 3 years earlier? How did people feel about it?
People were very divided about the Opera House at this stage. There were, of course, there were its devotees even then and many great supporters, but there were also lots of suspicions, lots of worry, of course, around the costs and the time it was taking. It was easy very much for certain sections of politics, say, to make arguments about not enough hospital beds, not enough classrooms when we're spending million after million on this building. So while it always had enormous supporters in one part of Sydney, I guess, there was also this very troubled feeling about it in other parts. And it was a feeling that was very easy to pick up politically and use in things like elections. The same thing happens now, of course, because beauty and art are very easily divided.
Well, it sounds like conversations we have today. Whenever we talk about a new public institution, something art-related, people always start talking about hospital beds. You write in the book about the Australian thoughts about this. You say it wasn't that they didn't understand beauty, but there was a sense of being embarrassed by it, that it was an indulgence. Is there something that still makes Australians cringe about embracing something that's just beautiful?
I think a really good illustration of that was the recent furore over the racing results on the Opera House sales. And to me, it felt as if nothing had changed since 1965, that we still couldn't bear to have beauty for beauty's sake or art for art's sake. We had to make it pay, or we had to flatten it out. We had to make it populist, if you like. I think there's a big seam of Australia that still feels like this about art. I'm not sure about in Sydney, but in Queensland, every time, you know, arts grants are published in the paper, there's another story about how many plumbers we could get for that, how many apprentices we could get for that money. Art still divides us, I think, a great deal in this place. I mean, I've got lots of theories about it. My hobby horse is about shame. I really feel like the underlying shame in Australia about our beginnings here makes us a bit fractious about certain things, makes us very defended. I think at a national level as well as at a personal level, shame can do that. It can make you angry. It can make you capable of violent thoughts. And I think we've still got a thick skin about our beginnings here, the terrible actions that occurred here with Indigenous people, the dispossession, the brutality. Somewhere, I think, underneath all of our skins runs this feeling. And I think it comes out in things like looking at a beautiful building or when we spend money on a beautiful painting like Blue Poles. It's almost like we don't deserve it.
Yeah, there's a sense that we shouldn't be allowed to have that.
Yeah, I think so. That's my feeling. I'm sure it's not shared by very many people, but after all the research and after all the thinking and the 5 or 6 years of writing, that was what kept coming out. And it was also a feeling I gave to the characters as well. I wanted to have a look at what shame did at a personal level as well as at a national level. And I think that's one of the effects it has. It makes us really distrustful of what we have in terms of beauty and especially of art.
So one of your characters, Axel, is this young Swedish glassmaker. He's come to make an installation to go inside the opera house. He's obsessed with the beauty of this building and the vision of the architect, Jonsson. I'm hoping you could read a short passage from the book, Christina, just as Axel walks up to this building.
Now, though he had been working at the site for a month, though he'd walked the same path to it every day, it still took him by surprise. The tremor of emotion as he rounded the quay and saw the sails arcing out of chaos, as if he'd come upon a rare and beautiful animal in a stark landscape. There was no Swedish word to describe this, no English word that he knew. It wasn't as simple as awe or even love. It was the clutch at his heart as he lifted his eyes to its curves and lines, its reach for beauty, a connection between the human and the sublime.
That's Christina Olsen reading from her new novel, Shell. Christina, that writing is just so beautiful and lyrical. I was surprised because I know your background is as a journalist. There's a real contrast between journalism and this beautiful poetic prose that you have in this book.
I think every book, you have to find the voice of the book. And this book demanded this voice. I can only say that. I mean, each book of mine has had a different voice, I think. But this was the voice that needed to be used, it seemed. I mean, it took me a very long time to find it. But once it started to come, I realised that this was going to be how the book would proceed in this way. It did take a very long time.
I guess it needs to be almost operatic in its scale to match the beauty of the opera house.
Absolutely. It did. That did occur to me as well. And I think the more the character of Axel developed, I realised that I was really thinking inside his head. And because he's, you know, struggling with English a little, I was thinking inside those dual languages. And I think sometimes when you're doing that, this is one thing I think we miss a great deal when we don't make sure our kids have another language apart from the one we speak every day, that there are so many other connotations in other languages and other ways of expressing the same thing. And that's what began, I think, to happen because I was also inside Axel's head and Axel's way of thinking so much.
Christina Olsen, the creation of the Opera House coincided with the Vietnam draft. How frightening was this time?
It was a terrible time in Australia's history. It wasn't that long, you know, since World War II. And even though we've been very good at covering up our feelings about that, it's only been, you know, the past 20 years or so that we've elevated Anzac Day and those sort of celebrations again. But for young men, the whole idea that their lives could hinge on a number dropping into a barrel or coming out of a barrel. And it was actually the barrel, you know, used for TATS lotteries. So it literally was a lottery. You know, if your birth date came out of that barrel, you, of course, you know, your number was literally up and off you went to war. These are young men in their 20s in the middle of the roaring 60s, the decade of protest and dissent and really free love. It was a much different way of life that they were living. The whole idea of war to most of them was absolutely abhorrent. And the idea of being made to go, of not having a choice about going, was terrifying. My brothers, well, two of my brothers, as it turns out, were way too young to think about that. It wasn't until much later that, of course, I realised that I had an older brother and that during Vietnam he was of conscriptable age as well. It kind of explained a few of my preoccupations to me, to be honest.
Yeah, this is detailed in your memoir where you write about a brother that was snatched from your mother's arms before
Yes.
you were born. So your mother knew that she didn't know where he was, but she knew he was of the age where he could have been conscripted to this war.
Yes, she knew it, but of course we didn't because we weren't aware of Peter's existence. But later, of course, all the pennies dropped for me and I realised why I had inherited this preoccupation with this time, because my mother had been preoccupied with it and spoke about it. She didn't speak about why, but it was certainly through her words and her push and talking around injustice that I began to think about these things much more deeply than I might have, I think.
So in Shell, it's your other character, Pearl Keough, who's very worried about the ballot. Why is she so worried?
She's got a very personal reason for being worried, but she's also a protester. She's very, very concerned and tied up with the protest movement. Pearl's background is that she was the eldest in a family. When the mother died, Pearl was 14. There were others beneath her. The two youngest boys, who she had literally helped to bring up, went to orphanages, as the other children did. But she's completely lost touch with these two boys. And of course, in 1965, as conscription is announced and Australia sends its first troops, she realises that she has no idea where they are. And the eldest one is of conscriptable age and the other one will be the year after. So she has this very personal reason and she's very, very intent on finding these boys and hiding them from the draft.
You mentioned that she's political. She's learned a lot of her Labor values from her father, a man
Yes.
who had a line of grease he could never scrub from his fingernails. And this
Yes.
book, Christina, it's full of union members, workers, protesters. Is it fair to say that your own political ideals are shining through this book?
I think just a little bit, Claire. Yes, perhaps. I think so. Certainly there are lots of working men in my family and I guess part of it is a very soft hymn to working people. They are my values, I have to say. Yes, I've for a very long time felt that injustice is at, you know, a very deep core of the way Australia works. And it's very hard to stand by when you've had a privileged life, which to me is just having enough food on the plate and a job to go to. It's very hard. Well, it's very hard for me to stand by and look at the world work in a different way. So I'm involved, for instance, in an organisation called Sisters Inside that advocates for the human rights of women and girls in the criminal justice system. That's my way of standing up, I suppose. Standing up is also at the core of the book, yeah.
Yeah, I've spoken to Melissa Lukashenko, who's involved in that organisation
Yes.
as well. One of your characters in the book says, the artist must take sides. Do you believe that writing and novel writing does need to be political?
At a personal level, for me, yes, it does. That may not work for everybody, but I feel that responsibility. I don't think I did as a younger person, but it was one of the reasons that I could no longer work in full-time journalism was that there were some things I realised on which I could no longer not take a side. The whole neutrality thing, of course, has been a very long preoccupation of mine because of my Swedish blood, I suppose, as well as my feelings about the Vietnam War. And also, I think, again, it comes back to that whole notion of Australia. I think when non-Indigenous people arrived here, I think we looked at Australia as completely neutral surface, as a neutral surface, completely uninscribed, when of course it was absolutely full of inscription and story of Indigenous people all over Australia. So, yeah, so the whole idea of objectivity, neutrality became really big sources of worry for me. And the book, this book was really one way of trying to come to terms or trying to understand what that meant to me and what I was willing to do.
Yeah, because I believe that coming from a Swedish background and Sweden being having a position of neutrality during the war, as a younger person, that was an idea that appealed to you. But your thinking about that neutrality has shifted?
I really did feel pretty chuffed with the idea of, you know, half my bloodline coming from a place that didn't take part in armed conflict. And I really wanted to get inside that to see what it meant. Of course, it's completely contested as a notion. People still feel very strongly, very angry with Sweden about the last World War, not least the Norwegians who suffered badly. Of course, all the Scandinavian countries had declared neutrality before the beginning of World War II. Norway was always going to fall, as was Denmark, because of their coasts, their coastlines that the Nazis wanted. But Sweden managed to maintain theirs. But the Norwegians and Danes suffered terribly and are still angry about some of Sweden's actions in terms of, for instance, letting the Germans in over the very top of Sweden into Norway, their continued trade with Germany during the Second World War. So I was really interested to have a look to see what that whole notion gave to a country and what it took away from a country. And it was pretty hard, you know. I love Sweden. I really do feel like it's my second homeland. And I had to look really hard at really hard things in this way and see, you know, what my idea of the real thing was or my idea of the truth was.
So you've moved from embracing neutrality to taking a side.
But I think it's a really personal decision, and taking a side means something different with each issue. Of course, I'd read a lot of Paul Robeson's speeches and talks, and it was something he said during the Spanish Civil War that really...
This is a singer, just to be clear, right? An American musician?
Yes, an American singer, a black singer. And during the Spanish Civil War, he had given a speech in which he said the artist must take sides, and that he had taken his side, and it was for his people, for black people and for working people, and he would always, always do that. So that really struck me in terms of, you know, what our responsibilities as artists are and how we play them out or how we walk away from them in each individual thing that we do. I think it's a really personal decision that we have to make with each piece of art that we make.
Christina Olsen, this novel has given me so much to think about. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Claire.
Christina Olsen's new book is Shell. It's published by Scribner. And Christina just mentioned the singer Paul Robeson, who appears on the first page of this book. In real life, actually, he sang for workers at the Sydney Opera House in 1960. So here's a bit of Paul Robeson and Old Man River.
I must keep fighting until I'm dying and all